Welcome to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Reinold with Paul Steinhauser here inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. This is the show that's all about the First Nation presidential primary and New Hampshire politics. We have a packed edition of the show today. Congressman John Delaney will join us in studio here in just a moment. And Paul and I have been busy out on the campaign trail. New polling is out from Quinnipiac, and that's a really good poll for Joe Biden at 29%, Bernie Sanders at 19%, and Beto O'Rourke, who was in state and on the program last week, at 12%. Paul, it's always good to see you.
Good to join you as well. And yeah, the O'Rourke numbers are interesting because they're, you know, a second national poll where he's in double digits. The other person who really popped in that poll is Pete Buttigieg, the South Bend, Indiana mayor, who, when he announced his exploratory committee back in January, he was the longest of long shots. Not any longer. He stood at 4% in the poll. That's in fifth place. You had Kamala Harris of California, the senator from California, at 8%. But he was at 4%, which is much higher. Basically, he's been at 0 or 1% in every poll. So he is definitely standing up now. He's having some big moments on the trail. He's a candidate on the rise. He's seeing a lot more campaign cash come in. He's seeing some big crowds. He's getting a ton of media attention nationally and in the early voting states. And I had a chance to ask him the other day about this surge in popularity.
Yeah, Buttigieg, you are not speaking in hyperbole, was the longest of long shots to begin this process, but he has impressed. I've continually heard from individuals when I talk with them about the candidates they've seen and like insiders and just people at events, and they say Buttigieg really has stood out. Either if they've seen them or not, they want to see him, and they'll have the opportunity to do so as he'll be in state next weekend with events on Friday in Manchester and Saturday in Concord at Gibson's bookstore.
What are you witnessing on the campaign trail as you go around? Are the crowds bigger, more energy? What are you seeing? Are events that you thought were going to be small house parties turning into almost rally size events?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I mean, actually, the first time I tasted it was in Portsmouth, which was before the CNN Town Hall. It was a Friday evening, I think. We came over for what I thought was going to be a meet and greet in a bar, and it really felt more like a rally when we got there. But that was just the beginning. Once the CNN Town Hall happened, it felt like just a step change in the level of energy and interest in what we're doing. And I went from, you know, trying to, especially making phone calls or even going in front of groups, I went from sort of introducing myself and hoping people would think it was worth listening to me for a minute and explaining how to say my name, to really encountering people who seem to take a real interest in what we're doing and building support that way. We saw it in South Carolina. We did events in Rock Hill, Columbia, and Greenville, and every one of them was just packed. So it's early, but it's encouraging.
What do you think is causing this? I mean, you and most of the other Democrats running for the nomination are close on the policies. You know, there's some differences,
that's right,
obviously, but so why all of a sudden this surge from you? What's making you stand out?
Well, I think tone and messenger are going to be really important in this cycle. I agree that, you know, something like 80% of our policy positions are actually going to converge. And so a lot of it, I think, will be a question of, you know, what kind of standing do you have to talk about these issues? There are obviously a lot of different kinds of qualifications being put forward in this competition, but I think the idea of being an executive local leadership from an industrial community and also having a military background and you know, being able to talk on a personal level about preparing for the world as it will look in 2050, I think that's maybe enabled me to reach people in a different way with our message. And you know, the other thing that's striking to me in terms of the reaction after the town hall is, you know, what I said in the town hall wasn't that different from what I say everywhere I go. So it suggests to me that there's a big appetite for what we have to say among people who simply haven't been exposed to it yet, and that the name of the game for us really will be exposure. But, you know, it's tough, even from the inside of a campaign where you want to believe you understand all of these dynamics. It's sometimes tough to map how much of this has to do with policy, with ideas, and how much of it has to do with intangibles.
You were your initial goal was to raise $1 million by the end of the first quarter. You're going to easily surpass that. I mean, $600,000 alone just after the CNN town hall. Any idea of where you think you may come in? Any kind of preview of what those numbers may look like?
probably not the right time to talk numbers, but I will say that we certainly raised the bar from our kind of initial expectations, and it's exciting. Look, we're still in a early building phase. I obviously don't have the kind of gilded fundraising base that I might have if I were, let's say a senator from Florida. But the grassroots response after the town hall has been amazing, and we're definitely making inroads in new places, and I think we'll be able to compete. We won't be, we won't be rolling in cash at the top of the list, but we're going to be in a position to build out the organization that we need to.
You brought this up a moment ago. Are you concerned about peaking too early? We've got a little over 10 months to go until the actual voting begins. And we've seen this in past cycles, some candidates really catching lightning in a bottle, but then it evaporates. Are you concerned that this is coming too soon?
I don't think so. I mean, it would be a nice problem to have, but you can get thrown. I was at the airport the other day, and as I made my way to the gate, four people came up to me, and that's the first. A good 400 people did not come up to me, right? So, every time you think you're kind of penetrating all over the place and you start believing your own hype, you got to remember that 90% of people haven't tuned into this process at all. And among those who have, there's still a majority who haven't really heard my message yet.
The new excitement, the new media attention, the money that's coming in, what is that going to allow you to do? Obviously expand the campaign, but how and what are the next steps?
Well, obviously we're now working on framing out an early state operation that is going to serve us well. It's still very important to me that we be administratively lean, that we not become top heavy. And it's also just our style, I think, to be a little more lean and scrappy maybe than some of the others. But we've got to make sure we have proper resources on every piece of the organization. And we're looking forward to rolling that out a little bit down the line. Also, as we look toward a launch, that's something you only get to do once and something you want to do right. And so we're making sure that, when we're ready to formally, officially, and finally pull the trigger on a full campaign, that we've gone about that in the right way. We're going to want people on the ground in the early states. We're going to want a robust finance operation to keep keep filling our sales. We've relied on a lot of brilliant people around the country as a policy network, but we'd like to staff up our policy process beyond the great help we've been getting from people volunteering their time and their intellect. And we think that we're going to have an approach on digital campaigning that will be, I think, pretty new and pretty fresh.
Any kind of hint on what that could be?
No, that was the hint.
And any kind of hint on the timetable for that announcement? Everybody else who did an exploratory, which I think was just Gillibrand, is now announced. When's your timetable?
Yeah, the more nationally famous you are and the more wealthy you are, the sooner you can flip from exploratory to full-blown. For us, there's more of a process here, but I will say more and more of those pieces that we needed have come into place, so we're going to be ready to do something, I think, pretty soon.
That is Pete Buttigieg. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Up next, my conversation with John Hickenlooper in Manchester. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Reinel with Paul Steinhauser. We are inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. Well, former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper was in the Granite State as he came to New Hampshire for the first time since announcing his presidential bid. I sat down with him in Manchester at the Crown Tavern. His events stretched through last weekend, included a stop in Concord at the Concord Craft Brewery. But this was prior to his first event here in the Granite State. We're out on the campaign trail with former governor of Colorado, John Hickenlooper, as he makes his first trip here to the Granite State as an official candidate for president. Excited to have him here with us. And tell us a little about your vision for the nation and what is the impetus behind this run.
Well, I look at America today, and I think we're in a crisis, a monumental crisis. A crisis of division. And I think you can go back to when I was a kid in the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War protests, but we're even more divided now than we were back then. I think we have to go back to the Civil War. And I look at my time is in the private sector as a restaurateur and business person, and my time in government, and I think I've consistently been able to bring people together and get them put down their weapons if they're feuding and get stuff done. And you know, in terms of healthcare, we're now, Colorado has almost universal healthcare coverage. We did it bipartisan. We took our economy from being 40th in job creation to being the number one economy in the country, according to U.S. News and World Report, for the last 2 years. And as we did that, we brought up not just the cities, but we brought up the rural areas. We're going to have one of the top rural economies as well. Then if you step and you look at climate change, we got the oil and gas industry to sit down with the environmental community and create methane regulations. Methane is the worst climate change pollutant that there is. I think, you know, I know I can beat Donald Trump, but I also think I can bring us together on the other side and get stuff done, you know, bring people together and actually create progressive achievement.
This division is one that has been coming about for a long period of time. And in my view, Donald Trump is a symptom of the problem, an individual who has capitalized on the problem, but not necessarily a person who has created the division. So how do you go about addressing the deep-seated and rooted divisions that occur within our country, most of which, in my view, are fueled by economics and lack of commonality and understanding amongst individuals? In other words, we did not get here as a result of one individual. We got here as a result of what was going on at the grassroots. So is it possible for a president to, you know, address the grassroots and to create change there?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I agree. You know, Donald Trump certainly didn't make anything better, but he is a symptom. I woke up in the middle of the night and I told my wife, defeating Donald Trump is absolutely essential, but it is not sufficient. In other words, we've got to recognize that after we beat Donald Trump, there has to be a way to bring people together. We're dealing with challenges like climate change, like the not just universal coverage for healthcare, but the incredible inflation that's been going on. Look at with automation and artificial intelligence, look at the disruption that's going to come to our workplace. And we're not doing anything to get ready for it, to be prepared for it. I think that's the one thing we've shown again and again that we can do in Colorado, and I think I can do it for the country, is to reach down into, you know, in the grassroots level and help people be the change, right? Help them be the resolution of these challenges.
You were criticized a bit during the CNN debate for a comment that was kind of, I think, offhand in regards to when you were asked about a female running mate. And you said, why not ask you about a male running mate? Do you regret that comment, or was it just kind of a back and forth that went awry?
Well, the point I was making was that, at least as I had heard, it seemed like men candidates were being asked that question. And I felt like, to a certain way of listening, it discounted the probability that a woman would be the candidate, and I was just pointing that out. I wasn't trying to make, you know, I wasn't trying to make any political points or anything. It was just, I thought it seemed a little more fair that they should be asking the question to both sides, to men and women, and just saying, you know, well, who are you thinking about for a vice president? Who are you thinking for a vice president?
In regards to what you would think about for a vice president, and you know what the feeling and philosophy is right now in regards to, you know, gender diversity and diversity as a whole, you know, one of the things that's been talked about a lot during the course of the run-up to this campaign is how everything has changed, and that individuals are feeling empowered at the grassroots level based upon Donald Trump or his forces challenging their stake in America. If you are a Muslim business owner, if you are a transgender member of the military, those challenges have been presented by this president. So are we at a moment in time where there is a need for a greater amount of gender diversity and diversity as a whole within government? And how do you go about representing that, obviously, since your makeup is different?
Well, I think diversity is one of the greatest strengths of the Democratic Party, but I also think it's one of the greatest strengths of America. I mean, this country was built on diversity. And I look at, you know, the ability of us to deal with some of these challenges is going to come from bringing, you know, everybody to the table and make sure that everybody's opinion, everybody's experience is part of the solution.
That is John Hickenlooper. He's the governor of Colorado, former governor of Colorado, joining us here as we hit the campaign trail with him. And you mentioned some of the key economic issues that our country is facing, artificial intelligence and how technology is taking away jobs. But to me, it's also in a lot of ways creating jobs as well. So how, as president, do you go about pushing forth, whether it's an infrastructure plan or a 21st century workforce plan, so that the jobs of the future are integrated within an infrastructure which will allow for everything to kind of work hand in hand?
Well, and you hit the nail on the head. I mean, right now, if you look at the Labor Department data that's coming out of Washington, there are about 7.2 million jobs unfilled, and there are 6.3 million people unemployed. In other words, we already don't have enough workers. The disconnection is in many cases the skills, and we have to revolutionize the way we deliver skills training to kids of all ages. And my argument is, I want to bring in the largest expansion of community colleges in the history of this country. I want to create free skills and ultimately free community colleges to make sure that, you know, anybody who wants to work hard enough has that opportunity to acquire the skills that allow them to create their own version of the American dream. That's the basic fundamental promise that America should give to all of its citizens.
Do you believe in universal pre-K? This is something that was talked about over here over the last week. Beto O'Rourke came to New Hampshire and others have brought this up. Do you think that there should be universal pre-K?
Well, unlike most of the other candidates, I delivered it, right? When I was mayor of Denver, we went out and we spent 30 months bringing in experts from all over the country. We had over 100 leading citizens, Republicans and Democrats. In the end, Pete Kors of the very conservative Kors family supported a sales tax increase that we passed to make sure that every four-year-old kid in the city of Denver would be able to have not just pre-K, but high-quality early childhood education. And we have objective measures of quality to make sure that the higher quality early childhood education gets rewarded and gets a higher compensation. I mean, I think it's a state-of-the-art model. Obviously, I don't know anyone who doesn't believe that quality early childhood education doesn't pay rich dividends.
What do you believe are the biggest foreign policy challenges that we face at this point in time? Are they economic? Are they a nuclear threat from North Korea? Is it instability, which continues in the Middle East, perhaps not as reported as much as in the past? Computer warfare and the ability for hackers or for governments to attack our grid or to engage in other acts of cyber warfare?
Well, let me start. I think the single most important aspect of the job of President of the United States is the responsibility that comes with being Commander-in-Chief. And let me say, the first thing I wouldn't do is ignore and disrespect the most experienced and talented military and intelligence experts in the world. And I certainly wouldn't alienate and diminish our oldest and longest standing allies, as President Trump has. I look at it, you know, the first thing I would do as president would be I would renew our strategic alliances, especially with those of our closest allies like NATO. How can we be talking about walking away from NATO? It's insane. And to just even contemplate it makes no sense. I would also make strategic investments in our intelligence systems and in our military systems. And first among those in the military side of things would be cybersecurity. We don't have any protocols right now when somebody breaks down and there's an incursion, somebody attacks us from a basement in Moscow. We don't know exactly what the protocol is for what's an appropriate response. We need to create those through negotiation. As governor, I tried to get to every deployment when we sent our National Guard troops into Iraq or Afghanistan. I tried to welcome our troops when they came home. And when we lost soldiers, I would grieve with their families, go to the funerals and experience that. I understand what this country's built upon and how significant our national security is. And it's something that should be treasured. And you have somebody like John McCain who, you know, gave a big chunk of his life for the freedom that most of us in this country enjoy. I certainly would never, ever denigrate a hero like that.
That is John Hickenlooper with me at the Crown Tavern in Manchester. This is On Background, presented by the Hampshire Healthcare Association. Up next, John Delaney joins us in studio. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan with Paul Steinhauser here inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street Studios. We're joined by former Congressman John Delaney, Democratic candidate for president back in the Granite State. And Congressman, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me again.
Good to see you. Appreciate you coming in. Tell us a little bit about how the race is going in your mind. As you see new candidates obviously getting in on a week-by-week basis into this contest, everybody's waiting on Joe Biden. We see ups and downs in terms of the polling based upon those candidates getting in.
Yep.
How do you assess the race at this point?
Well, I guess I wasn't successful at clearing the field.
You were not.
So I'll start with that. Now, I mean, it's funny. I told my team about two months ago or 3 months ago, I said, listen, there's going to be a lot of people getting in over the next, call it 3-4 months, and there's going to be a new story a week or every 2 weeks, and it's going to create, you know, a very kind of shifting dynamic. And we just got to keep our head down, and we got to do our work, and we got to talk to voters about what matters to them. And then, you know, come late spring, early summer, the field will be set, and then the race really starts. And that's how I think about it.
And you have to get into the debates as well.
Exactly.
And how? What's the process like for you in terms of being able to do that?
Well, you need to get register at a certain level on 3 qualifying polls, and we've registered on 2 so far. And, you know, we're fairly confident that there'll be a 3rd poll that comes out between, you know, now and the debates, and or there'll be several probably, and we think it's a high likelihood we'll register in any number of those, so we think it's going to be fine.
Is that the strategy for you, is to kind of get to that point in time and allow for the debate to create a moment for you while you're doing your work out on the trail, you're distinguishing yourself from your opponents, and that the debate is going to be what thrusts you forward?
Yeah, but again, I don't think it's necessarily the debates. I mean, the debates are important, and you got to do a good job. But I think it's deeper than that. I think the Democratic Party is going through its own debate right now about what it's looking for. And we're throwing around a lot of ideas, a lot of solutions, a lot of different approaches, some of which I think is a great discussion, some of which I think could take us down a path where we're not that competitive against the president. So I think the Democratic Party is going to kind of sort through all these issues between now and the fall. And in the fall, there's going to be a real focus on a couple of things, right? The first thing will be who can beat the president. I think that'll be by far be the most important criteria. The second thing is who's got really the best ideas, right? Who's not just kind of saying stuff, but who actually has real plans to make some of this stuff happen. And I think thirdly, I think Democrats are going to realize that this election in 2020 should not be about kind of throwing the whole model of the country out the window and starting from scratch. That feels like a very tough race to win. But it should be about who can actually bring the country together, restore a sense of decency and honesty to the presidency, and can actually convey to the American people that under my presidency, I will get real things done that matter in your lives. And I think by the fall, that's where the Democratic Party is going to be, and that's where we are as a candidate. That's where I am as a person.
You've been a more moderate, let's say, than a lot of the field.
Yes.
And you stand out for that. When you look at some of your rivals for the nomination, you know, the Green New Deal they're pushing, Medicare for All, free college tuition, great ideas, but are they realistic? Scrapping the filibuster in the Senate, getting rid of the Electoral College. Are you worried that they're moving a little too far to the left, too extreme?
Yes. You know, I think, listen, you have to put forth ideas that make sense. Some of those ideas are ways of dealing with real problems that are really, truly problems, but they're not the right way of dealing with them. You know, climate change is a huge problem. I have a better approach. Creating universal health care, I agree we should have universal health care. I have a better approach. So I think at the end of the day, the American people don't want solutions that don't work. If you look at the 2018 midterm elections, where the Democrats took over the House of Representatives, the lesson from that midterm was that we won competitive districts by putting forth candidates who had real solutions that were workable. They showed people how they're going to pay for them. They focused on bringing people together to get them done. And they didn't run as extreme candidates. And in many ways, the United States of America is a giant purple district, right? The country is a competitive country. And so the lessons of 2018 should be obvious to us. If we want to flip a competitive district or a competitive country, we have to do it with a more moderate, solutions-oriented candidate.
So do you think some of your rivals are running as extreme candidates, and are they handing handing him ammunition?
They're running on things that aren't real solutions. For example, addressing climate change, which is a very serious problem when we're running out of time on it. It comes up all the time here in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. I did a climate roundtable in Portsmouth. And you have to have a real solution. If you say the way I'm going to address climate change is by tying it to universal basic income or by tying it to universal health care, you're basically saying you're not going to do anything on climate change. So the real question is climate change an issue or not? If it is, put forth a solution that you can get done. Don't put forth a solution that just keeps moving the goalposts.
So as they move the goalposts, do they hand the president and Republicans ammunition?
Look, the Mueller report has been a game changer. I don't think most Democrats really want to acknowledge that, but it has been. You combine that with a reasonably good economy, and you've got a situation out there that unless we put forth a what I call a big tent Democrat, in other words, someone who can actually win the center, then we're handing him a pretty good hand.
And you said handing him a pretty good hand. You said previous that if the argument becomes about changing America, and I think a capitalism versus socialism type of argument, whether it's real or framed as such, is argument that Democrats are going to have very little success in winning. And Bernie Sanders is a self-proclaimed Democratic socialist. You see Kamala Harris and other progressives pushing forth plans and proposals that can be described as such. So just if you feel if the party nominates a Bernie Sanders or some of the individuals that I mentioned, are they doomed to failure?
Well, I don't want to say doomed to failure because I think, you know, the president is in my judgment, really unfit to be the president of this country. And I think any number of the people that I'm running against would be better than he is. But I look at it really simply. If we make this election about some of those issues, like throwing out the whole economic model of the United States of America and starting with a new one, that feels tough to me. If we make this election about someone who's honest because the president is dishonest, if we make this election about someone who's decent because the president is indecent, if we make this election about someone who actually wants to bring people together and solve problems, which the president is not doing, you know, if we make this election about helping working families as opposed to giving tax cuts to the largest corporations in this country, if we make this election about improving health care as opposed to attacking the Affordable Care Act, if we make the election about those things, I feel really good that we're going to win.
Do you feel, though, that Bernie Sanders can beat Donald Trump?
Listen, I think anyone should be able to beat Donald Trump if they run on the right things.
That is Congressman John Delaney joining us here inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. We're doing on background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. On policy issues, you mentioned the ability to be able to do multiple things upon achieving office. How many things do you feel can be accomplished in that first 100 days? Or is it just that one particular item that you would have to focus upon?
Well, I think the one unique item I would focus on is national service. I want to create a program that every high school graduate has an opportunity to serve their country. Not mandatory, but an exciting program to actually get more people involved in public service and bring us together. So I think that's a unique idea. But really, my first 100-day agenda is going to be about four or five or six things that are currently bipartisan proposals in the Congress, literally word for word. Because I'm going to say to the American people, I represent every one of you, whether you voted for me or not. And to prove it, here's my agenda for the first 3 months. And these are bills that good-minded Democrats and Republicans have worked together for years and formed real coalitions around. And that's what I'm going to advance, because that'll prove to you that I actually want to represent every one of you.
one of the big issues for Democrats in their successful takeover of the U.S. House last November was health care.
Yes.
You're out with a new plan on prescription drugs and lowering the prices. Tell us about it.
So there's two things I want to do. One is I want to allow the government to negotiate Medicare prices. Every single Democrat running for the president wants to do that. Mm-hmm. And we should do that. It's obvious. The only reason we're not doing it is because of the drug industry lobby. But the second thing I want to do, which I'm the only one talking about, is actually get at the real issue with drug prices, which is the fact that the U.S. consumer is subsidizing the whole world. So if you go to Europe, to Germany, other wealthy countries, they're going to pay about a third of what you and I pay for drugs in this country. And the reason for that is they negotiate one price. No matter where you get your drugs in Germany, everyone pays the same price. And they have one person in the government who negotiates that price. And they negotiate the price really low, sometimes below cost. And then what the pharmaceutical companies do is they jack up the prices here to make their profit that allows them to actually invest in innovation. And I find that to be fundamentally unfair, that the world is free riding on our backs, on the backs of New Hampshire residents.
Congressman Delaney, as always, great to see you and look forward to talking again soon.
Thank you.
All right, that is Congressman John Delaney, presidential candidate, to joining us here on Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. We'll come back with more from inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio after this. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Well, Bill Weld is getting closer and closer to a primary challenge of Donald Trump. He spent much of the last week here in the Granite State meeting with key Republicans and also sitting down with Paul and myself, as well as key Republican strategist Mike Dennehy for Pints in Politics. And Weld was not willing to really go after Donald Trump at all in regards to the Mueller report, or really talk about that too much at all. But he did say that he is inching closer to a run and looking like it's going to be April for him.
Yeah, and it's interesting, as you mentioned, you know, it's less about Donald Trump now as he gets closer to launching a primary challenge, and more about why he thinks he should be president and why he's the true conservative in the race. So kind of a little change of language by Weld. He's been up here every week. This week when he sat down with us, he had some interesting meetings as well, high-profile meetings with Governor Chris Sununu and with Steve Dupree, who's the longtime RNC member from New Hampshire, Chris.
So let's hear part of that Pints of Politics conversation with Governor Weld. Let's start with the Mueller report, which, of course, has been released in part via a letter by Attorney General Barr to Congress, to members of the public, a four-page letter summarizing the findings of Robert Mueller. I'm interested, first and foremost, in your takeaways from the letter and what needs to happen moving forward.
Well, my takeaway is that my old colleague Bob Mueller from the Reagan Justice Department did a great job with his customary thoroughness. And I think, the net takeaway is a positive. I think the country can be relieved and relaxed that the answer to the question, did our sitting president conspire with a foreign power to procure his own election, the answer to that question is no. And that's a good thing for the United States of America as well as for Donald J. Trump.
Right. So do you feel, though, that there has been that has thoroughly been proven at this point with just the release of the four pages? Or do you feel there needs to be, you know, more information that gets released to the public and to Congress?
Well, I think that obviously the whole report should be made public. I mean, it's pretty expensive to produce. The American public owns that report, in my view, and the House of Representatives tends to agree, having voted by 420 to nothing, that the report should be made public.
In regards to what this means moving forward, do you feel that the president is exonerated, as he has said and has the his White House staff has pushed forward? Has he in fact been exonerated by this report, particularly on the issue of obstruction of justice?
Well, yes, on the issue that it looked into, yes. I mean, there's other stuff swirling around, and I wish the president wouldn't use the language of organized crime in discussing the legal cases, like so-and-so is a rat. That's what they say in La Cosa Nostra, you know. So there's other matters that I'm sure will come up, but I regard this as, you know, one step in a journey of 10,000 miles. There's thousands of questions that will be asked and answered about all the candidates for president in this next election, Republican and Democrat, and this is, you know, a good day for the president. I think it's also, as I said, a good day for the United States of America.
I'm going to turn this over to Paul and Mike on our panel here in a second, but the language of exoneration was not that of Robert Mueller on the obstruction of justice issue. The language of exoneration was that of Attorney General Barr along with Associate Rod Rosenstein. Do you feel that there is a need for Mueller to testify in front of Congress and that there is some degree of ambiguity about whether or not Barr's words are Mueller's words?
I don't know. I think both Barr and Rosenstein are pretty solid guys. Their word is good enough for me. Bob Mueller declined to draw his own legal conclusions, and he said, here's the evidence, A, B, and C. And then the top two people in the department made their cut on it. That's good enough for me, frankly.
Bring in now Paul Steinhauser. Paul?
Governor, you've been up here almost every week since you made the announcement.
Every week.
Every week. I don't want to shortchange you.
No, almost about it.
Question, though. Does the news from the Mueller report kind of take the wind out of your sails, the reason for a primary challenge against this president?
Well, no. I mean, that's only one of the many, many questions that have been raised about the president. But my reason for running is that I'd like to do the job in Washington. You know, I had two terms as governor. I was an economic conservative. I was ranked the most fiscally conservative governor in the United States. There's no economic conservatives in Washington these days, including, in my humble estimation, the president of the United States. You know, the budget they just filed adds $7.9 trillion, admittedly over 10 years, but $8 trillion to the accumulated deficit. So we're now over $30 trillion. I don't think that's fair to the next generation, my children and grandchildren, to the millennials, the Gen Xs. They're going to have to foot that bill. We're not going to pay for that. You know, old cadres like me and the president, we're not going to pay that bill. So I don't think it's fair to the next generations.
But politically, does it make what was a long shot now even longer?
No, I wasn't really counting on the president getting caught in the soup for having said, I hope the Russians find some more emails during the heat of the campaign. That never grabbed me as an indictable or impeachable offense, frankly.
Mike?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I couldn't have said anything better than what Governor Weld just said. From the Mueller report to a reason for challenging President Trump, I think it'd be fabulous to have a debate on the issues. None of this made up nonsense that's coming out of the Mueller report now. Most Republicans, if not all Republicans, believed that there was no there. And the report has just flushed that out. And so now, I think for the betterment of the country, let's move on. And like Governor Weld said, hey, let's talk about the issues and where we disagree, whether it's taxes or spending or regulation.
Or free trade versus tariffs, or what to do about the fact we're going to lose 15% to 25% of our jobs to artificial intelligence and robotics and drones in the next 10 years. You know, we got to re-educate those displaced workers so they can get higher paying jobs as replacements.
And you know, I do think, Chris, and I guess to your and Paul's point here, let's face it, there is a, what you would call a never-Trump, anti-Trump movement. I think it's a small group of people, and it's a very vocal group of people, but I don't think that impacts anything but the way those people think, not the general voting population. And it's going to be every candidate's job to make their case to the voters.
I think in regards to the Never Trump movement individuals who will never support the president, there is certainly the aspect of policy that you're describing, Mike, but I think that one of the key issues as well is the character of the individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm interested in Governor Weld hearing you on that. I mean, you've mentioned the policy differences, but one significant aspect of the Russia investigation is that, okay, there may not have been provable collusion which took place, and I don't think that's much of a surprise to individuals who follow this case closely, but there is questions about how far the administration went in contacts. There's also questions about the character of the individual and the President of the United States, and how much of that is pushing you forward on this?
Well, what's pushing me forward is I'd like to do the job. You know, I'd like to be elected. For better or worse, I've felt for the last 10 or 15 years that I could start Monday in the Oval Office and make, good judgments that would, by definition, be consonant with my my policies. So I'd like to do the job. I'd like to get there, as Mike was saying, by being able to vet these issues with the president, or you know, whether it's a debate or not, at least rival messages every day as we get down the line. So in terms of the president and personality, as you say, the one thing that sticks in my craw a little bit is the demonizing of groups. And it started with the immigration policy, and Muslims are awful, but it seems to just keep going on. There's always somebody who's guilty of threatening the purity of the United States. You know, we are a melting pot. We have been since we started. You know, anyone who rejects that and tries to play on divisiveness, I think, is a mistake. I always tried to include everybody when I was governor of Massachusetts, and it goes all the way back to when I started practicing law in a little firm. Everybody had, a title and a job, and the purpose of that, and we were all in our early 20s, the purpose was to unleash everybody's energy, and I think that's a great thing. I think part of the job description of the president should be to make everybody feel good about being Americans. Everybody, not just half of the Americans.
So your framing of this is not being an individual who is running against Donald Trump for the Republican nomination. You are framing this as being Bill Weld, who wants to be president of the United States.
That's absolutely right. And I have run the show for two terms, and I know what it is to have the power to run your own show, and it's very satisfying, but I do it for other people. I'm not doing it for myself. And if you don't have a short priority list for what you want to do in a public office, you shouldn't run for it.
Paul?
We've got two meetings this week that are of a lot of interest to me and a bunch of others. First of all, today, Steve Dupree, longtime RNC member, former chair.
I overlapped with Steve a lot when he was party chair and I was governor. I used to come up here. I ran into him earlier, and he was saying, yeah, we had people cancel, and you would always come right up 93 and give the speech, which I remember fondly.
What do you hope to get out of that meeting, plus the closed-door meeting tomorrow with Governor Sununu? And is there any change on your timetable for when you may actually go forward with this?
You know, there is. I think it's accelerating. I think it's now month of April for making that decision without telegraphing too much. Governor Sununu, I gave, I think, three fundraisers for when he was running in 2016. So he and I are buddies. And we were both at the Wild Irish Roast in Nashua a few days ago, and he made a point of saying, I'm with Governor Sununu, I'm with Trump all the way, but let me tell you, this guy Bill Weld, he's not chopped liver, it's okay. That'll be a friendly meeting.
How do you get to that voter, the Chris Sununu type voter, the voter who is with Trump all the way, but likes you enough to be nice to you? How do you get to that voter?
I think that describes a lot of people, and it kind of goes back almost to the 2016 campaign when I was complaining about the R party and the D party in Washington being locked in a spiral death embrace. They need each other. That's why it's an embrace, in order to scare their constituents into giving them a lot of money so they can get reelected, which is everybody's obsession in Washington, D.C. And so what I hope to do is persuade people, you don't have to vote for someone because they're in the R party or the D party. You can think for yourself and make your own decision. And then I would say, I want to do A, B, C, D, E. And, well, since they're my positions, I would hope they seem reasonable to people. And then they say, oh, okay, I don't have to vote for the D or the R or whatever. I can vote for the person with these five positions who seems like a reasonable enough guy.
You can check out the entirety of our Pints in Politics at our website, nhtalkradio.com. Interesting stuff from him there, Paul, as we've seen a shift where initially he was going to plant that flag and primary Donald Trump and make it all about him, it seemed like, particularly after that speech at St. Anselm College. But now a shift where it's more towards him being a presidential candidate as opposed to an individual who is looking to bring the Republican Party back to where he believes it should be and take it away to some extent from Donald Trump.
Yeah, and he says that the findings, the summary findings from the Mueller report had no basis and didn't impact his decision making at all. But I think you're seeing a clear shift of strategy here, you know, post Mueller report findings coming out for World. And listen, he also said that he didn't think that the news, the blockbuster news, impacted his primary challenge decision. But let's be honest, it does. It makes a long shot for for Weld much, much longer as he tries to unseat the president in the GOP nomination.
That is Paul Steinhauser. I am Chris Ryan. This has been another fabulous edition of On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.